That's nice. Looks like the people are starting to flow in.
Right. Yeah, we'll take the first 15 for Q&A, then we'll jump in and some more Q&A.
Okay. As the attendees start to flow in, I remind everyone that if you have a question, please put it into the Q&A, not the chat, unless you have questions for other people who are participating or attending. But if you have questions for Hugh, please make sure they go in the Q&A, and I'll be curating the Q&A and pose the questions orally to Hugh as we get going. This will be a little bit different format as we get going, but at first, that's the way we'll do it. We have 15 participants now, and we're recording. Welcome to everyone. It looks like the flow of entries is reduced quite a bit. I think we can get going if you want to open us in prayer, and then yeah, I'll start with the questions.
That'd be great. Okay, Father in heaven, we thank you for this time. Thank you that every day that you give us here on earth is a special gift from you. Help us to use that wisely. And pray, Father, that we be submissive towards you and open up our hearts to receive more of your love, your life, and your truth. And guide and direct us, build character in us as we engage one another this day, the character of Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you. The first question comes from an email that I received on the paradoxes.org site. Let me drag it over here so I can read it. First of all, the question starts with my question. It comes from Sam Maddy from Canada. And the question is, around the miracle of fire from the Church of Sepulchre on Easter Eve that started very early after the Lord's resurrection. What is your view on that?
Well, I'm not familiar with that at all, so I don't have a view. I'm willing to check it out, but I hate to take a stab at that, not knowing anything about that subject. But it does sound interesting.
Okay. Sam Maddy, your question was posed. Hugh doesn't know what the answer is, but if he finds a chance to look up what that miracle of fire of the Church of Sepulchre is, then we'll get back to you and we'll pose it on another Q&A.
Yeah, what would help is if Hugh would actually give me the exact reference, so the church, spell it out correctly, and send it to hross@reasons.org. That way I can check it out.
Okay, there you have it, Sam. Thank you, Hugh. Says, this is a good holiday question about turkey and dressing. Is being overweight ever a sin? And if so, at what point is it a sin? And can moderation ever be sinful? Like, for example, eating in moderation is not bad, but how about witnessing in moderation? Or is it, or can it be a sin of omission? And lastly, he says, another example might be not helping someone who needs help. What do you think? Is this a common weakness of modern Christians?
Well, it is. We all commit sins of omission. And with respect to his first comment about, eating, the Bible does say that we should take care of our physical bodies because our physical bodies are an instrument to serve the Lord. So we can keep ourselves healthy. That enables us to minister more effectively. So we should engage in physical training as well as mental and spiritual training, which means we should be not getting drunk and not overeating. And so we do have an obesity crisis here in America. But I think part of it is that, just in the few years I've been here on earth, I've seen a transition where the poor were undernourished and maybe underfed. And now it's the other way around. They're overfed and overnourished. And part of the problem, I think, is that back in the 1950s, for example, the cheapest food was a food that would not make you fat. Today, it's the opposite way around, that the cheapest food is a food that does tend to put pounds on you. And also, the poor tend to be working several jobs and therefore, when they need to eat, having prepared food. Again, if you go back 50, 60, 70 years, the poor were always preparing their own food because they couldn't afford to buy prepared food. Now it's the other way around. The prepared food is actually cheaper to buy. So there's a reason why people with a lot of wealth tend to live healthier lives than those that don't. Just the economics of food has drastically changed. One thing I think is helpful is that different nations of the world are now passing laws against the use of fructose. It's in the scientific literature that the body is not able to respond. I'm not talking about natural fructose, but the adding, corn syrup that they add, high fructose sugars that they add to foods. It's really cheap. And people like the taste. But there's been proven in the scientific literature that our brain is not able to recognize that as calories and therefore sees it as a non-caloric intake. And therefore the body's hunger system basically demands more food than it needs. And so a number of nations of the world are actually, some have actually put a ban in effect. And I think it's coming here to America as well, where that food additive will be banned from all foods. And that probably will go a long ways to dealing with the obesity crisis that we're facing. And the other things that was mentioned in the question, again, about moderation, yes, the Bible does tell us that you can drink alcohol, for example, but to do it in moderation. And I wrote an article, you'll see it as on my Today's New Reason to Believe, where I address the scientific evidence of what moderation is. Basically, moderation is that which will not affect the health of your brain or your body, but it's such that the science now shows us that moderation levels are quite a bit lower than what we thought even a decade ago. So it was once thought, for example, that having a glass of wine every day is drinking in moderation. The new scientific evidence is saying two or three glasses a week is moderation. Having one every day over a long period of time will have health consequences and brain function consequences. So that's a debatable issue. I mean, what is moderation? And, we should continue to study that. I don't know if there's anything else in that question, Mark.
Well, the question is, if you don't eat in moderation, is that a sin?
Well, it's a sin in the sense that you're doing damage to your physical body, and the Lord has commanded us to take care of our physical body so we can more effectively minister his grace and wisdom to others. That's the context. And what's moderation for me might be different for someone else. So, Paul warns us to not be critical towards one another. We're all different. It's a difficult one to answer, if it's clearly doing you a health damage, then yes, you need to correct that.
And then the last part of that was, is witnessing in moderation, can that be a sin of omission?
It can be. I think God gives us opportunities. I mean, one thing I've noticed is if you're not regularly practicing sharing your faith, it becomes more difficult to recognize the opportunities that God gives you. And you can go the other way. I've seen lots of Christians force their witness upon people that are not willing to listen. And that can drive people away just as effectively as not taking the opportunities that God gives you. You say, how do you, and that's why 1 Peter 3:15 says, always be prepared to give good reasons for your hope and faith in Jesus Christ, but with gentleness and respect and a clear conscience. So don't force the opportunities, but don't miss the opportunities either. And don't punish yourself if you tend to slide one way or the other. It takes practice to try to find where that fine line is of omitting opportunities that God has given you and forcing opportunities that God has not given you. So practice. And get feedback. I find that unbelievers are very willing to give you good feedback on where you're out of balance.
Perfect, thank you. Mark Durham asks, is there any further word on the James Webb Satellite Telescope? Is launch still on schedule?
Well, right now they're talking about a December launch time. In fact, in one of my Facebook posts, I put down the latest date. I think it's like, I think it was like December 18th, if I remember right. That's the date they had. So it was supposed to go up this month, but it was October 31st. Then they delayed it to the first week of November, then late November. Now it's December 18th. And yes, people are wondering, when is this thing ever going to go up? But I'm sympathetic. I mean, it's at the launch site, so it's all ready to launch. The rocket is there. It's all set up. But you only got one shot. I mean, they're talking about putting this telescope a million miles away from the Earth. And so naturally, given the expense of the project and the fact that they can't afford any error to happen, if there is the slightest bit of bad weather, I know they'll delay the launch because they want to make sure that this is not like the Hubble Space Telescope where they launched and said, oops, we forgot something. They want to make sure nothing goes wrong.
Thank you. Tim Williams asks, what is your approach to the dating of census of Luke 2:2, which some take is occurring around 6 AD during the governorship of Quirinius in Syria?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of debate about that. How do you square this with Herod? I mean, those are the historical. You got the census, you got Herod's death, and these dates have been debated. I mean, there's a range of dates that you'll see in the literature as to when Herod died. Most people think it was 4 BC, but some are saying 5 BC, even 6 BC. And so the census of Quirinius, I mean, that could be consistent. And there again, you've got disputes about the date. So the fact that the dates coincide within about a plus or minus 3-year window, that doesn't concern me. I'm prepared to wait and see. I'm not sure we're ever going to get great dates. And then there's also dates about, what about the Christmas star? And I commented on those dates in some articles I've written for Today's New Reason to Believe that the appearance of the Christmas star could be 5 BC. And again, people have taken a range of dates anywhere from 1 BC all the way back to 7 BC for the Star of Bethlehem. So will we ever get an exact to the month date? I don't think we will. But it's certainly earlier than 0 BC and not earlier than 10 BC. So somewhere between 0 and 10. And most scholars would say somewhere between 2 and 7 BC is when the dates concerning the birth of Christ, they fall within that range. And that's consistent too with a prophecy you see in Daniel chapter 9 as to when the Messiah will come. Although most scholars would recognize that the coming of the Messiah, as prophesied in Daniel 9, is referring to the beginning of his ministry. And the text tells us, the gospel text, that his ministry began when he was about 30 years of age. But about 30, that could be plus or minus 2, or maybe even 3. So, that doesn't bother me that the dates are not accurately pinning it down to a month or a year.
Thank you. Keith Wilson says, I've seen people from opposite perspectives on creation accuse RTB of being racist because RTB does not regard Neanderthals, Denisovans, etc. as part of the human race. As I understand it, the Bible puts the creation of mankind as the pinnacle of all creation, but that all creation, including mankind, have devolved since, rather than as having gradually arisen, from primitive ancestors. How do you answer the criticism?
Well, I'm actually going to talk about that in the teaching time because I just got back from the Evangelical Theological Society / Evangelical Philosophical Society conference. It was held in Fort Worth, Texas. And that was predominantly, it wasn't the theme, the theme was poverty and wealth, but the interest and the attendance was really focused on these very questions, particularly in the context of William Lane Craig bringing out his book, In the Quest of the Historical Adam. So that drew a lot of the attention, and I attended those sessions, so I'll be commenting on it. But yeah, that was one thing that was actually raised in one of the sessions, that we got to be careful what we say about Neanderthal, because if Neanderthal is fully human, then to put him in a lesser category is to make a racist statement. So that actually came up. And so I'll be addressing that once we get into the teaching time.
Jeff asks, how do you account for potential supernatural intervention when evaluating a claim scientifically? For example, when looking at the first humans, could supernatural actions skew our scientific conclusions?
Well, they definitely can, because often science is operating from a naturalistic perspective, and there is a supernatural intervention that's going to lead to some conflict. I mean, I'll give you just one example. You know, geneticists have been looking at the genetic diversity of the present human population and saying to have all of humanity descended from one man and one woman in less than 100,000 years, you're going to have too much genetic diversity to explain by science in the first humans. But it's based on the assumption that when God created Eve, he created her with a set of eggs, reproductive eggs, that is what we see in women today. Namely, they get it from their mothers. God, since God supernaturally created Adam and created Eve, he could have created Eve with her reproductive eggs sufficiently genetically distinct from one another to easily accommodate the genetic distinctives that we see in the human population today. And that would make sense, because what we notice is that if you got all of humanity descended from one man and one woman, then you're going to have brother-sister marriages, at least in the early part of human history. And therefore, God creating Eve with genetically distinct eggs would alleviate that risk. And that's something you see in Genesis. In Genesis, there's no prohibition against brother-sister marriages. Abraham, for example, was married to his half-sister. When you get to the book of Exodus, there is a prohibition. And, you know, basically, and we see this with wild animals, that you can take a wild male and female from a species, and you can breed them and breed brothers and sisters, and you can do it for several consecutive generations without running the risk of propagating a genetic defect, typically up to 20 generations. And therefore, from that basis, we can understand why the prohibition against brother-sister marriages doesn't show up until the book of Exodus. And hey, there are parts of the world today where it probably be a good idea to prohibit first cousins from marrying because of the degree of you know, interbreeding that does happen within those isolated populations. So it's all a matter, and notice that's part of the health law that we see in the Torah.
Great. It's now 10:48. It's perfect time for you to start your wrap-up of your conference.
Well, okay. I'm going to do something different today. Usually I have a prepared keynote presentation that I take you through. And I do have a couple of slides, but I'm going to save those. And I was amazed how much of the Evangelical Theological Society / Evangelical Philosophical Society conference was dedicated to the subject matter of what we're teaching here in Paradoxes, dual revelation. And I think part of it is the result of the fact that just a few weeks ago, William Lane Craig, most of us call him Bill Craig, he's a very prominent philosopher and theologian, has written like 40 books, and is particularly famous for the debates he's had with atheists, both theologians, philosophers, and scientists over the years. And, you know, I've known Bill for 35 years. We've shared the platform frequently on different university campuses. About 3 years ago, he let me know, well, actually 4 years ago, that he was gonna, you know, says, I've never taken a stand on, biological evolution. I really haven't taken a stand what I think about the early chapters of Genesis and Adam and Eve. Although he's been consistent in saying that he thinks concordism is the wrong way to go. And so he takes a very different perspective in due revelation than I do and has for the past decade. But he says, Hugh, I'm really going to take some time off and research this whole question about Adam and Eve. And so he spent 2 years studying this subject and has just come up with a book. And the book is titled In Quest of the Historical Adam, A Biblical and Scientific Exploration. So that's the title and subtitle. But if you look at the back cover states the scientific case for Adam as an historical person who lived between 750,000 and a million years ago as a member of the archaic human species, Homo heidelbergensis. And so, yes, and if you look at the book, he's really defending the case that all of humanity is descended from one man and one woman. So he does believe in a literal Adam and a literal Eve, but in a way that's very different from what we posit at Reasons to Believe. So Reasons to Believe, we have a date for God creating Adam and Eve sometime during the last ice age, based on the fact that the four rivers that are described in Genesis chapter 2 do not come into one locale on the present earth, but they do during the last ice age. Because the last ice age, the sea levels were as much as 390 feet lower, and therefore the four named rivers in the Genesis 2 do actually come together on dry land, but only during an ice age. So sometime during the last ice age, we got God creating Adam and Eve. And just looking at Genesis 2, that would put Adam as being created by God somewhere between 15,000 and 130,000 years ago. And we actually have a more precise date than that based on the understanding of what we see in the flood accounts and what we see in the scientific evidence. But Bill is taking this position. That was, it's about 2 years ago, I heard that he was going to put Adam back as far as half a million years. And now he's putting him back somewhere between 750,000 and a million years ago. So he's got a very early date for God creating Adam and Eve. And the book is 439 pages. And it's not a small book either in terms of size. It measures more than 9 inches by 6.5 inches by 1.5 inches thick. So it's a big, thick book. And as I looked at the book, I was surprised by how much was left out. Matter of fact, and I'll give you just kind of the setting for the drama. They had about 4 hours devoted, and that was in one meeting. They had another meeting as well for a full hour. But for a little more than 4 hours, it was devoted to a review of Bill Craig's book. And so Ken Keithley, who's a member of our Reasons to Believe scholar community, he was the moderator, and he began by giving a short review of what's in Bill's book. Actually had a handout for all of us, which was very helpful. And then there were four theologians that each gave a 15-minute review of Bill Craig's book. And then Bill had a half hour to respond to the statements. And then about 40 minutes was devoted to Q&A. And actually, I think the four had more than 15 minutes because we're talking more than 4 hours total. Anyway, I remember as we were approaching the Q&A time, there was a theologian there, also a member of our scholar community. And he says, Hugh, see this $5? I'll give you the $5 if you get to ask a question. I was going to ask a question anyway without the $5, but I had my hand up during the entire 40 minutes, and I was never recognized by the moderator. But that somewhat worked in my favor, because if I did have a chance to ask a question, because of all the people asking questions, I would have had to be very brief And basically, we were called make a brief question and have Bill respond. But afterwards, everybody was gathering around me and saying, Hugh, what did you want to ask? And we'd love to have your take on what you've heard and what you think about Bill's book and his talk. So I got to talk to people for quite a while afterwards about this. But what I want to do now is kind of give you a review, because I see this as a significant change in Bill Craig's theology. And also, during that four-year period, I kept offering Bill, hey, I know you're working on this. We've been studying this for decades at Reasons to Believe. We're open. We'd love to talk to you and help you with your research. But he never took advantage of the offer, the repeated offers we made to help him with this study. And mainly because I think he recognizes Reasons to Believe as an organization that believes that a literal reading of the Bible concords with a true understanding of the record of nature, the scientific record. And he, at least for the last 10 years, has disavowed himself of that position. So I think that's probably the primary reason why he did not want to consult with us. But let me give you a review of what's in the book. And this is a direct quote from page 166 and 167. He says, quote, ancients lack capacity for speculative thought. They engage in mythopoetic thinking. And so I read more in the book about that. And it's something we've been addressing here in the Paradoxes class in our study of dual revelation. Craig seems to be joining the army of conservative theologians who have this position that the ancient peoples were intellectually inferior to us. And so that's just a one-sentence quote, but you can actually read what's going on in this book. And I have definitely got the impression that that's the position he takes. They're not able to engage in a kind of, what he means by speculative thought is where we say, okay, let's look at the evidence we're seeing. What are the possibilities for explaining the evidence? He claims the ancients didn't think that way, and that what they were doing was engaging in these mythopoetic enterprises. And I'm mentioning in the class that we need to realize that the ancients were just like us. They were not intellectually inferior. They were not scientifically ignorant. A lot of these theologians, I think Bill joins the crowd in thinking the theologians really didn't have any interest in science. And I've been giving evidence in the class refuting that claim and making the point, yeah, they're intellectually our equals. And I think some of this is driven. What I see in the secular scientific literature is that we humans are evolving and we're still evolving. So, of course, every successive generation of humans is going to be intellectually more capable than previous generations. So I think a lot of that is driving this thinking. But it's concerning to me that it's beginning to penetrate into our conservative seminaries. And Bill has also written some articles, probably the one that's been best known. This has been out for several months. He wrote an article called The Historical Adam in the Catholic magazine, First Things. By the way, I got a good thing. First Things is a great magazine/journal that's put up by the Roman Catholic Church. And they solicit articles from across the Christian spectrum. And I've written for the magazine slash journal, and many others as well as have. But I think you get actually clear statements in that article, because he had to be brief. He couldn't write 440 pages. And so you actually get a more concise statement. And people have been telling me when they read his book, it's difficult to figure out exactly what Bill's position is, what he's saying, but he was very clear in the article that he wrote for First Things. So I'm just going to give you a couple of quotes from that that I think will help. He says, quote, if the first 11 chapters of Genesis are in one sense myth, they are in another sense history. And at the Evangelical Theological Society morning that was devoted to that was devoted to Bill's book. The whole theme was Genesis is mytho-history. Parts of it are myth, parts of it is history. And he's not referring to Genesis 12 to 50. He says, yes, that is literal. That is chronological. That's real history. His focus was on Genesis 1 through 11. And you know, Genesis 1 to 11 has been a subject of debate for theologians for centuries. So he's really focusing in these first 11 chapters. And then he gives them a little longer statement. I'll read this. He says, quote, Genesis presents a history of the world that's extremely short by ancient standards. There's one reason why he thinks it's myth, because of how brief what we see about creation in Genesis. I'll begin again. Quote, Genesis presents a history of the world that's extremely short by ancient standards, bound tightly by father-son genealogies. We should not imagine that the genealogies contemplate the enormous leaps that would be necessary to bring them into harmony to what we know of the history of mankind. But neither should we imagine that they comprise purely fictitious chapters. We can avoid these antitheses by understanding the brief history they chronicle as mytho-history, not to be taken literally, end quote. And so, as I was listening to Craig, he sees a completely literal Genesis as implausible, and therefore parts of it must be mythical. On page 109 of his book, he states a description of creation day 4 cannot be literal, since photosynthesis cannot occur without the sun. He also asserts that there's no scientific evidence for a worldwide flood. That was on page 121. And this kind of is what I was hearing. He's saying, there's no way we can take Genesis 1 to 11 as literal and historical and as chronological. But at least from my perspective, as a president of Reasons to Believe, I see him looking at the literal, historical. He's using a straw man argument. He's saying, if we take a literal, that means the text is saying there is no sun to the fourth day. Well, I've written a book, books on this, actually plural, making the point that if you read Genesis 1 literally, it's the light of the sun that appears on creation day 1. But on creation day 1, we have Earth's atmosphere with very little oxygen, and therefore it's extremely hazy. So hazy, the creatures on the surface of the Earth, they can see the light of the sun, but they can't see the sun in the sky. And if you ever lived, for example, I grew up in coastal British Columbia, where we have a lot of winter fog. And when you got a lot of fog, you can't see the sun anytime during the day. And the early Earth, because it had so little oxygen, it was a very thick haze all the time. And it wasn't until the fourth day, when you got the very rapid rise in oxygen, that the atmosphere clears and creatures on the surface of the Earth can actually see the sun, moon, and stars. But Bill evidently thinks that if you take Genesis 1 literally, you're forced to interpret that the sun was not created until the fourth day. Likewise, the moon and the stars were not created until the fourth day. But if you actually look at the initial statement of creation day 4, verse 14, Genesis 1, 14, it says, let there be the great lights. Just like when you look at Genesis 1, 3, it says, let there be light. That's not when God created the light. That's when he allows the light to come through to the surface of the earth. So God created light in the beginning when he created the universe. But Earth's atmosphere began dark. And it says that explicitly in Job 38, 8, and 9, that God had blanketed the primordial seas of the earth with clouds that kept the seas dark. And so it's the transformation of the atmosphere from opaque to translucent that permitted the light of the sun to come to the surface of the earth, but not until creation day 4. And the fact that it uses the verb hayah, let there be. Now, if it said that God had created the great lights, that would be different. But it says, let there be, then explains the reason why. Let there be the great lights so that they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. And the animals that God was going to create on creation day 5, they're the species of life that needs to know the position of the sun, moon, and stars in the sky to regulate their complex biological clocks. And perhaps Bill is tripping up on Genesis 1:16, because 1:16 says, so God made the sun, moon, and stars. And there it uses the verb asah, which means God manufactured. It's basically saying God had a direct personal role in forming the stars. But it's not like English, you know, and Bill has taken biblical Hebrew. I mean, he knows biblical Hebrew, and in biblical Hebrew, you don't have verb tenses like you do in English. So when it says, so God made the sun, moon, and stars, it's basically saying God manufactured these stars sometime in the past. It's not saying they were made in the fourth day. It was saying they were already constructed by God by the fourth day. So, and then Bill makes a statement, hey, if you take Genesis 1 to 11 literally, then you got the problem with a global flood. But again, my position is if you take the Bible literally and integrate all 66 books of the Bible, it actually refutes a global flood. It doesn't teach a global flood. 2 Peter 2:5, the world of ungodly people was flooded by the flood of Noah. So it's the world that was inhabited by ungodly people that was flooded. And they were the ones that were wiped out by Noah's flood. And the animals that were domesticated by these people, they also were wiped out. Again, if you read the text carefully in Genesis 7 and 8, it's not saying all animal life was wiped out in the face of the earth. It uses the Hebrew noun basar, which is basically a reference to the soulish animals that were in relationship or domesticated by these ungodly people. They were the ones wiped out by the flood. And if you go to 2 Peter 3, 5, and 6, it says the world that existed at that time was wiped out. So the fact that it uses this Greek phrase, cosmos tote, qualifying the world, the word cosmos with the adjective tote, tells us that Peter is distinguishing the world of Noah from the world of Rome. And the world of Rome was the Roman Empire. And Peter's basically saying the world of Noah is different from the world of Rome. And also, I've made reference to the fact that if you actually go to the creation texts in Psalms and Job and Proverbs, they explicitly refute the idea that the flood could be global. Probably the most explicit text is Psalm 104. That's the longest of the creation Psalms. And when it addresses creation day three, when God transforms planet Earth from a world with only water on its surface to a world where you got waters and continents, once the continents are there, Psalm 104 verse 9 says, never again will water cover the whole face of the earth. So that statement explicitly rules out the possibility of a globally extensive flood. But I saw this repeatedly during that session that Bill kept saying, there's no way you can defend scientifically a literal reading of Genesis 1 to 11. And, you know, I got to explain to people after the session was over, there's other ways of literally, historically, chronologically reading Genesis 1 through 11 where you don't wind up with something that's scientifically implausible or scientifically indefensible. That was Bill's comment all along. Hey, if you take Genesis 1 to 11 as a completely literal, then you've got an implausibility problem. You simply cannot reconcile it. Well, you can't reconcile it with a straw man interpretations of a literal. And I've always been on record in saying, I think it's more literal and more consistent that Genesis 1 to 11 is teaching a flood that wiped out the world of humanity, and one where the sun actually predates the six creation days. And I'm picking a couple examples. He was also talking about other implausibilities. And it's interesting listening to his defense, and the book goes into this in detail. of why we have to look at Genesis 1 to 11, at least as in part, as a mythical. He talks about the fact that the text includes fantastical elements. And so as we look at ancient Near Eastern myths, creation myths in particular, they all contain fantastic elements. And what Bill meant by that, elements that could not possibly be true if you take them literally, actually, it's making a theological point. And the examples he gave at the talk, and you explicitly see them in his book, is he says, a talking snake, that clearly is something that's fantastic and not meant to be taken literally. And then he also talked about the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and said it's just fantastical to think that God put these trees in the garden that had these magical properties. And I was encouraged that one theologian stepped up and said, wait a minute, it may be your opinion that these are fantastical elements. And Bill actually talked about 12 different fantastical elements. I'm just giving you a couple of examples, but he made more going through Genesis 1 through 11. But a theologian did get up and made a, what I thought was a very good response, and said, well, you're also going to have a problem with the book of Numbers, because in the book of Numbers, you got a donkey that's talking. And so if you're going to dismiss Genesis 2 because, or Genesis 3 because of this talking snake, what are you going to do about Balaam's donkey? And so making the point now, you're stuck with having to look at many texts as being fantastical and therefore not literal. And he gave many other, and basically said, I'm not buying this idea that Genesis 1 to 11 contains fantastical elements. And I would totally agree that, hey, we're talking about a God that can perform miracles. And we see God performing miracles throughout the Old and New Testament. Well, let me give you a little bit more here. And I think it's just fair to quote Craig verbatim. Here's another one. He says, quote, if Genesis 1 to 11 functions as mythical history, then these chapters need not be read literally. The accounts of the origin and fall of man are clearly metaphorical or figurative in nature, featuring as they do anthropomorphic deity incompatible with the transcendent God of the creation text. So he actually talks about how God is described differently in Genesis 1, the creator of the universe, than he is described in Genesis 2 and 3. And a number of theologians sitting around me were quite disturbed hearing that statement, and particularly the idea that what Genesis is saying about the origin of humanity and the fall of humanity need to be understood figuratively. It's like, wait a minute, what did we do? And I've mentioned this in the dual revelation class we've been going through, is that there's more at stake in the sense that as people begin to back away from this idea that God reveals himself in a compatible way through the book of nature and the book of scripture, that you begin to doubt what the Bible is saying about the origin of humanity, but it also impacts what you believe about original sin. And people in the audience asked Bill that question directly, and he dodged it. So I'm not sure. He basically says, you know, I haven't really come to an understanding of that. But I mean, most theologians do consider that a crucial doctrine of the Christian faith, that all of us humans get our sin nature from the one man, Adam. And then Craig goes on to say, quote, we may imagine an initial population of hominins, animals that were like human beings in many respects, but lacked the capacity for rational thought. Out of this population, God selected two and furnished them with intellects by renovating their brains and endowing them with rational souls. So that's how he's able to integrate what you see from some physical anthropologists and geneticists who say, look at the genetic diversity of humans today, the ancestral human population they would claim on that basis cannot be the biblical two. It has to be a population. And so Bill concedes that point, that there was a population from which we're descended. He's basically saying God went to that population of hominins, selected one man and one woman, and miraculously transformed their brains so they could engage in the spiritual, philosophical activities, and endowed them with rational souls. They became spirit beings. So he basically says the rest of the hominins, God did not give them the spirit, did not give them enhanced brain capacities. He took that from two individuals and were descended from those two individuals. So it's quite different from the model we have at Reasons to Believe, where we're saying God didn't select from a population. He de novo created one man and one woman from the dust of the earth and supernaturally implanted within them the spirit and made them the image of God from whom we're all descended. So Bill and I do agree that we're all descended from one man and one woman. We disagree about God selecting two from a population. That's not our position at Reasons to Believe. But Bill is trying to concord, the Bible. You know, in one sense, I mean, he took three opportunities to diss the concordist view that we hold at Reasons to Believe during that morning session. Never addressed me personally or named Reasons to Believe, but took multiple opportunities to say, we have to abandon the concordist approach to scripture. But in one sense, I see him engaging in a concordism, only he's trying to concord a different interpretation of science with the Bible than we are at Reasons to Believe. And that's probably the biggest difference. I mean, that's one thing I noticed right away, is probably the biggest difference is that Bill is convinced that Neanderthals are fully human and have all the capabilities that we human beings have. And that therefore, Adam gave rise to the Neanderthals and to all of us who are distinct from the Neanderthals, and therefore is forced into the position of saying Adam has to be the progenitor of all human beings alive on planet Earth today and throughout human history, plus all the Neanderthals and all the Denisovans. And therefore, he looks back in the hominid fossil record for someone that could be the ancestor to all the Neanderthals and the humans, and basically says Homo heidelbergensis. So it's one reason why he pushes the date as far back as he does. And he chooses Homo heidelbergensis because likewise he thinks that the scientific literature supports that they had fully human capabilities. So that explains why he comes up with his date of 750,000 to a million years ago. I'll go on. Here's another quote. Genesis 1 to 11 describes people who actually lived and events that really happened, but the people and events are clothed in the metaphorical and figurative language of myth. But now you got the problem that we've had for a couple of hundred years. How do you distinguish between what's myth in the Bible and not true and what is literal and historical? And, as a number of theologians have pointed out, this means that we need these trained higher critics who can tell us common lay folks what in the Bible is myth and what in the Bible is historical. And rather than every human being be capable of reading scripture for themselves, now we need these experts to tell us what parts we can see as history and what parts we can see as myth. And everybody was interested in how Bill was going to actually take his views on Genesis 1 to 11 in light of what New Testament authors state. And this is what he says on page 240 of his book. New Testament authors sometimes refer to the historical Adam and other times to the literal Adam. Pardon me, that's actually in the First Things article. What he says on page 240, however, really caught my attention. He says, with respect to the literal Adam and or the literary Adam and the historical Adam, he says, here Paul has misinterpreted the literal Adam, the literary Adam. So he actually accuses Paul of making an error in the book of Romans, basically saying he actually has confused the literary Adam with the historical Adam. And so that caught my attention. And Genesis, Craig's proof of Genesis myth, he says, he made a big deal about this. He's noted the repeated use of individuals' names in Genesis 1 to 11. We see Adam being mentioned repeatedly, and Eve, you got Cain, and then you got Noah. And he says, that's a signal of myth, because that's what you see in the ancient Near Eastern myths. They take a few key individuals and they repeatedly mention the name. And he says that happens 10 times in Genesis 1 to 11. So that's clear evidence that it's myth as opposed to history. Then he says the inclusion of fantastic elements, which I've already talked about. And then the fact that he says it's impossible to reconcile a literal historical reading of Genesis 1 to 11 with what we know for sure is in the scientific record. But again, I'm saying it's a straw man interpretation. He has a very different idea of what a literal interpretation of Genesis 1 to 11 than what I would have. And the problem is Craig wants readers to both trust the Bible and trust anthropologists whose claims seemingly conflict with the Bible. He wants a synthesis of faith and reason. I mean, that's kind of the mantra of his organization, Reasonable Faith, a synthesis of faith and reason, but it's per the dictates of present-day non-Christian anthropologists and geneticists. And again, I think he's giving way too much credit to what these few authors are saying about the genetics and about the anthropological evidence. Now, I want to make a few comments about Neanderthals because I know I'm getting close to the end of my time here. And you'll find a wealth of articles on Neanderthals on our reasons.org website, especially from my colleague, Fazal Rana, our staff biochemist. And, I've talked to Bill when he was here at our office in Covina, California, 2 years ago. We invited him to critique our human origins model. So I had a brief chance to talk to him. And he says, Hugh, we have to concede that Neanderthals are fully human because of their remarkable capabilities. And one of the things he cited was they got control of fire. Well, my colleague Fazal Rana basically says, when you look at the anthropological literature, you not only need to read one paper saying, hey, look at this evidence, you need to read what other anthropologists are saying about that paper. And there's one thing, the anthropology literature is quite different than what you see about particle physics or about cosmology or about galaxy structure. A lot of debate and a lot of critiquing going back and forth. So this idea that there's a consensus in the anthropological literature that Neanderthals had control of fire, that is a myth. I mean, in fact, I say way more papers publishing that refute that idea. You know, one of the things that Fuzz has noticed in one of his articles is that, you know, if Neanderthals had control of fire, why is it we only see evidence of that in the heat of the summer and not in the winter? If they had control of fire, you'd expect you would have a lot more evidence that they were controlling fire during the coldest times of the year. But we see none of that. It's only when you have the hot summers that you see this evidence that they were, quote, controlling fire. And we don't see any evidence that they were baking bread like we do with the earliest humans. What we do see is evidence that Neanderthals opportunistically took advantage of wildfires. And that explains why the evidence is all in the summertime and not the wintertime. Winters, you don't have wildfires. The summertime, you do. So there's a lot of snow on the ground. It's hard to have a wildfire. And Fuzz has made the point, we see nothing in Neanderthal activity that's distinct from what we see in the chimpanzees. Chimpanzees on the planet with us today opportunistically took advantage of wildfires. They do seem to have the intelligence to recognize the wind patterns of the fire. And so they recognize where the fire is going to go and can figure out what's going to happen. And what we've seen with chimpanzees, they'll gather up all these nuts nuts that they're not able to break open with their stone tools. And what they'll do is they'll throw these nuts on the wildfire, and then they kind of hang around the wildfire until the wildfire peters out. And then they go back when everything is cooled down, and they gathered up all these roasted nuts, and now they're able to crack them open, and they're able to eat the nuts. And we see that same thing with the Neanderthals, that their relationship with fire was one of wildfire, taking advantage of wildfires rather than actually having control over wildfires. And there's a lot of articles claiming that they buried their dead. And both Fuzz and I have written articles saying it's all based on evidence that they find flower pollen within, say, 20 feet of some bones of a Neanderthal where the bones are buried. And basically, you got anthropologists saying they must have had a funeral service where they took the body of this Neanderthal, and a bunch of Neanderthals gathered around them. They purposely buried it, and they heaved the flowers on top of the body. And in fact, we have no evidence that the Neanderthals were burying their dead. Yes, we do see evidence of Neanderthal skeletons that have been buried, but the burial could easily be totally natural. It doesn't have to be purposeful burial. And the fact that we see flower pollen in the vicinity, that could be completely accidental. After all, flowers are fairly ubiquitous throughout the habitat of Neanderthals. And then there's claims that they wore clothes. But there again, you got the problem that humans were living in climate zones 15 degrees colder than what the Neanderthals were living in. And that's because humans were quickly able to manufacture clothes and use those clothes to keep themselves warm in a cold climate. There is some possible evidence that Neanderthals were taking advantage of animal hides. So for example, they may have killed a big animal, eaten the animal, and then used the hide to cover over themselves during the cold. What we see with humans is they were actually harvesting small animals and sewing the pelts of these small animals into sophisticated clothing. We see no evidence for that for the Neanderthals. At best, we see them taking advantage of a large-bodied animal and using the hide of that animal to keep themselves warm. We see no evidence that they were manufacturing clothing, where we see abundant evidence that for humans. And we need to recognize the anatomy of Neanderthals gives them a huge advantage over humans in cold climates because they have a barrel-shaped body. They got short limbs. They have an enormous nasal capacity. These are all anatomical tools to enable you to live in a cold climate. Humans didn't have that. We were slim. We were tall. We did not have a barrel-shaped rib cage that's rather cylindrical. We didn't have a lot of body fat or body hair, and we didn't have those big nasal capacities. And yet humans, very early on, the earliest humans, we have evidence that they were living in far colder climes than what the Neanderthals were living in, which is basically evidence they were not manufacturing or using clothing. And, talking to Bill 2 years ago, he made a big deal about the fact, well, we see Homo erectus using spears, and these spears are sophisticated. In fact, he told me that they've actually found a spear dated to be a 500,000 years old that looked to be just as sophisticated as an Olympic javelin. And he says, hey, if it's just like an Olympic javelin, then they had to have just as great of cognitive capability, symbolic capability as we human beings. However, if you read the scientific literature, what they found was a single piece of wood. And yes, it was about as long as an Olympic javelin. And in 500,000 years, it's going to have significant decay. People were simply interpreting that perhaps this piece of wood actually had all the qualities of an Olympic javelin. It was similar, not exactly, but similar. given the corrosion that would have happened. And we see that in chimpanzees today. Chimpanzees will actually take branches off of a tree and strip the branches and create a rather effective spear weapon that they use to hunt bush babies. And they quickly figure out, okay, this one is actually better than this one. And so we would expect that Homo erectus likewise would have figured out, hey, I grabbed this thing off, I stripped all the leaves off, I got all the the side branches shaved off, used a stone scraping tool. We would expect all that and quickly figure out, hey, this one actually works better than that one. So they throw one away and use another one. So it's not at all surprising that they end up with something that's similar to an Olympic javelin. And Bill is also very much believing this idea that Neanderthals were making sophisticated spears, where you got a piece of wood, you got this shaped stone, a spear tip on it, and you got tar and twine interwound. And it's based on the idea that papers have been published claiming that Neanderthals were able to manufacture, even distill, and use tar to make weapons. And my colleague Fazal Rana has gone through the literature and saying that conclusion simply has no scientific bearing. It's possible that they were capturing natural tar from birch trees, and we have no idea how they used it. And this idea about twine, it's all based on one paper where they find three threads weaved together in a manner that looks kind of like how we weave three strands to make together rope. But I've written an article on this. Buzz has written a couple of articles. We make the point, hey, when you actually look at that, juncture of three threads, we're only looking at a millimeter. You know, when you read what Bill has said, it looks like we've got a very complex weave like you would see in a bow and arrow or a modern spear that was used by the ancients in battle. That's not what we're seeing. The paper is all based on these three threads, and a number of scholars have pointed out we're seeing there may have no animal agency whatsoever. We're seeing three tiny threads. The dimensions no greater than a millimeter, and we see this all the time. Matter of fact, I wrote in my piece, we see this in plants where you get these kinds of webs or weave constructs happening, and it's completely done without any animal input whatsoever. Well, I want to give time for questions because I see I've gone about a half hour here. So a little more than that, actually, I'm sorry. So I'm going to stop there and take questions. I did get to give a paper at the conference. The paper I gave was on fine tuning as an argument for God, basically showing how that argument is getting stronger and stronger with every year goes by, and how you can answer the atheists who claim that fine tuning is not a worthy argument for God. And basically I showed, hey, we can demonstrate it is powerful predictive power, power to predict future scientific discoveries. And I gave many examples. I've written a paper on this. And hey, if you want the paper, I'd be happy to email it to anybody who like this. It's about 22 pages long. And I didn't read the paper. I gave a keynote presentation and basically said, hey, this complements what's in the paper. The other thing I'll say is at that conference, I did attend a session on biblical inerrancy. And, I really appreciated Wayne Grudem, the theologian who's written the book on systematic theology, now in its second edition. And he's one of the few remaining attendees of the meetings that took place in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Most of the 300 theologians that were part of that conference have now passed on. I only know of a handful of people that are still alive. Wayne Grudem was a student, a PhD student at the time. And so he's young enough to survive. I know that there was one scientist that was part of it. And that was Walter Bradley. He's still alive. Almost everybody else has passed on. I might give a brief report on that next week, because that was a very interesting thing. But I think the thing that caught me the most is Wayne's statement, every generation of Christians must battle this idea, is the Bible inerrant? It comes up in every single generation, and see that all the way through church history. And it's basically saying we shouldn't be surprised that we're having to do battle in biblical inerrancy again. And incidentally, that rippled throughout the entire conference. The Evangelical Theological Society is based on the doctrine of biblical inerrancy. However, a lot of people that are members of the Evangelical Theological Society have very different views on biblical inerrancy than what we see stated in the affirmations and denials of the International Council of Biblical Inerrancy. I'm going to stop there. So, Mark, I think we only have to take some time for Q&A.
Okay, we have some left over. Tinny Washington says, hi, Dr. Ross, how do you counter skeptics who argue that archaeology doesn't support a united Israel existing around 1000 BC, around the time of King Solomon, or if that even Solomon or David existed?
Yeah, that's a little bit out of date, because they've done enough digging around Jerusalem where they now recognize that the city of David was real. I mean, I visited Israel in 1980, and when we were there in 1980, none of the archaeology digs of the city of David had yet been completed. What we saw there is they were just beginning to start the archaeological digs. And at that time, you saw in textbooks, hey, this idea that there was a united kingdom with David and Solomon as actual kings, ruling over a powerful nation of Israel. They were claiming that was all a myth, but that claim really doesn't withstand the latest archaeological discoveries, especially on the south side of the old city of Jerusalem. It really does reveal that there was a King David, and that there was this city as described in the Bible. And, you know, there's a lot in the Bible that does not yet have archaeological evidence supporting it. But as many archaeologists, biblical archaeologists have pointed out, every time an archaeologist puts a spade into the ground of Israel, they come up with additional evidence for the historicity of the Old Testament. So 100% of the evidence does support the historicity. Do we have complete evidence? No, we don't. But particularly in the last decade, the evidence that sustains the United Kingdom, ruled over first by King David and then by King Solomon, very difficult to refute that in light of the latest archaeological digs.
Thank you. The next question, set of questions, comes from Doug McComb. I'm not going to ask all of them, so we have time for others. But he says, good morning. Last week, we had an excellent speaker who's a particle physicist. Can you please elaborate on some things about the Higgs boson, also known by a minority of physicists as a God particle? Why was it called a God particle by Nobel laureate Leon Lederman, the physicist? And when did this single particle or group of particles first exist? Do we know when and why it came into existence?
Yeah, I mean, there's some good articles online on the Higgs boson. And yeah, it was called the God particle, but it was a term, the fellow who coined that term was an atheist. And so people looked at a, hey, God particle, maybe that's the particle that proves the existence of God. That's not how the term was ever intended. Although now people are beginning to think about it in a different way. But it was coined the God particle because the Higgs boson and the standard particle creation model explains how the mass of particles get their mass. And, you know, it's a cornerstone of the what's called the standard model of particle physics, but it would take enormous energy densities to discover it. That was the motivation, one of the big motivations for building the Large Hadron Collider. They made it 17 miles long because they knew that it would take that length to get the energy densities in the particle accelerator where they'd be able to discover, is this Higgs boson a real particle? And does it have the properties that we think it does per the particle standard model called particle creation? and several years ago that the Higgs boson was discovered. And now there's an effort at the Large Hadron Collider to try to more accurately measure its mass and other properties, just to see to what degree this is fully consistent with the standard model of particle creation. And so far, everything is consistent with that standard model. I may have missed a point to that question, so if I did, remind me.
Oh, you got it.
I got it? Okay, yeah. Good.
Yeah. Your memory is really good. Okay, let's go to Jack Daly. On the YouTube clip, a woman asked how you go from theism to Christianity. And you said there were three ways and you had only time to explain one. Where can I find all three ways?
Well, another way, I mean, the way I described was to make the point through fine tuning that we see greater evidence for fine tuning when we put the fine tuning in the context of what's necessary for billions of human beings to hear and respond to the gospel message and become disciples of Jesus Christ. That statement that we see in Revelation 7:9, that the number of humans who will be part of the redeemed host in heaven will be an uncountable number for every tribe, nation, language, and people. That implies that you must have a large human population with the technology and with the wealth that all of them can hear in some detail the gospel message and respond and receive Christ's offer of redemption. So the fact that we see exponentially greater fine-tuning evidence in that context, and that literally everything, this is the theme of my next book, Design to the Core, that no matter what size scale you look at the universe, from the, you know, the scale of the large-scale structure of the universe and the cosmic web, all the way down to the fundamental particles, whatever size scale you look at, you see it's been designed to make possible the redemption of billions of human beings, sustaining the biblical doctrine that God began his works of redemption before he created anything at all. But another way you can use science to establish that it's a God of the Bible rather than, say, a theistic God, gods that you see in the other religions of the world, is looking at the scientific evidence for triune God. And I've written an article on this that was published in 2016 as one of my Today New Reasons to Believe articles, making the point that science only makes sense from a Trinitarian perspective. And Christianity is the only religion amongst all the religions of the world that teaches that God is a triune being, where you got three persons that make up a single Godhead. As Ken Samples, our staff theologian, would put it, it's three persons and one essence. And what he and many other theologians mean by one essence, whether you're looking at God the Father, God the Son, or God the Holy Spirit, you got the identical character attributes, you got the identical plan and purpose for creating. So they don't have different ideas and plans about creation. So when you look at God the Son, you're seeing all the attributes of a God the Father, and likewise with God the Holy Spirit. They do divide their labor, as it says in 1 John, where it talks about how the three together make up a light, and that light has three components, where the Father bestows love on his creation, the Son bestows life upon the creation, and the Spirit bestows truth. So the three persons do divide their labor and basically make the point that the problem with the monotheistic religions, the religions that are strictly monotheistic, where they not only say that God is one essence, they say that God is a single person, is they really cannot explain the origin of love. I mean, love by definition means you've got a relationship between two distinct persons. And so the problem with Judaism and Islam is they really have no answer for love. I mean, we human beings have the capacity to love one another, Where did that love come from? You're saying God is one person, and you're saying a being that never experienced love or expressed love created beings that can do both, which in one sense would make us humans greater than God, or at least put God in a position where he must create in order to experience and express love. You don't have that problem if God is triune. But the problem with Hinduism or Hinduism and Buddhism is you've got these many gods. And one, you know, I had an opportunity during this pandemic to speak to audiences in India many times. And what's interesting is you see a real movement towards Christianity amongst engineers and scientists. And the reason why is these engineers and scientists recognize what they're learning about science is not compatible with Hindu theology, but it is compatible with Christian theology. Because in Hindu theology, you've got these millions of gods that all have a distinct role in creation. And they're not like the triune God where they all have the same plan, purpose, and mind and attributes. They're distinct. And therefore, in Hindu science, what you see in Hindu theology is that science is going to be filled with incongruities, inconsistencies, and apparent contradictions because all these different gods are involved. But when we look at the scientific record, we don't see that. We see harmony. We see consistency across the board. And it's our guide to making future scientific discoveries. And I'm trying to remember what the third argument was. I wrote it in that article that I published in 2016, but right now, so my memory isn't all that great, Mark.
Okay, well, you did well with what you had. Susan Lambeau asks, were those four named rivers named in Genesis even there 750,000 to a million years ago?
Well, they were there when there was an ice age. I mean, every 100,000 years or for the past 800,000 years, you get an ice age that lasts about 90,000 years. And so, yeah, when you got an ice age, you got a lot of the planet's water as thick ice sheets over the continents, which means the ocean levels will be lower. And with the ocean levels lower, those four rivers will be above sea level to a point where there'll be a place, namely the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf, where those four named rivers will come together. So that can only happen during an ice age when the sea levels are sufficiently low. So yeah, if you're willing to go back a million years, there'd be multiple times throughout that million years where those four rivers would be together. So I don't see that as a critique of Bill's model, because somewhere between 750,000 to a million years ago, those four rivers would indeed come close together on dry land.
Great, thank you. Juan Mancha says the basal or basal, B-A-S-A-L group, said straightforward hypothesis is that the extant populations of almost all animal species have arrived at similar result consequent to a similar process of expansion from mitochondrial uniformity within the last one to several hundred thousand years. Does that speak to Noah?
Well, I'm not sure what Vaughn's getting at there, but I'll take a stab at that to make the point. And this is something I meant to say about the Neanderthals. And this also applies to Heidelbergensis and Homo erectus. Recent papers now demonstrate that their population levels were not high. I mean, we got billions of humans on the face of the earth. At most, at any given time, there might have been 25,000 Neanderthals on the face of the earth. But most anthropologists believe the number likely was never above 8,000. If you got a population level that low, you've got an animal that will not evolve. Mammals, and that explains why we look at the hominid fossil record. What we notice is we can't see any evolution over the time span that Neanderthals were on the face of the earth. They were on the face of the earth between about a quarter of a million years ago to about 50,000 years ago. And we see no evidence for evolution. But with a population level that low, we wouldn't expect to see any evidence. With Homo erectus, you've got somewhere between 1.2 in 1.8 million years, depending how you interpret the dating methods. But likewise, we see no evidence that they evolved over that time span. And again, with a low population level, you wouldn't expect to see any evidence. But I've cited several papers over the years making the point that when conservation biologists do their field experiments, what they notice is for mammals with an adult body size greater than 3 kilograms, you're looking at a species that will go extinct before it can experience any significant evolution. And all the bipedal primates that preceded us human beings were much larger than 3 kilograms in adult body size. And also their population levels were much too low for them to have any possibility of evolution. And so that raises the question then, how do you explain these creatures? I think God specially created every distinct one of those species. And I think I've shared this with the class before. There was a meeting that Faisal Rana, my colleague, attended, where it was about 24 theistic evolutionists debating this idea about how do we explain Adam and Eve in the context of naturalistic evolution. The meeting was also attended by the atheist anthropologist, Ian Tattersall. But Ian and Fuzz tells me, he says, Ian and I had much more in common with one another, even though I was a Christian and he was an atheist, than either of us had with the theistic evolutionists. Because Ian Tattersall, as we do, believes that we human beings are distinct, exceptional, that we're the only ones with high cognitive capability, symbolic capability, and the ability to advance technology. And incidentally, I didn't say this, Craig also cites his evidence for symbolism on the part of Neanderthals, but it's based on a single paper where they see vertical scratches on a wall, where you got some of the scratches going at a diagonal instead of just up and down. And people made the claim, hey, that looks like some sophisticated alphabet. But hey, I've seen bears do the same thing with their claws. So it's all a matter of interpretation. Did I miss anything on that, Mark?
No, it looks like I think you got it.
Okay.
All right, let's go to David Edwards in Rancho Santa Margarita, California. In the documentary Black Holes, The Edge of All We Know on Netflix, they talk about the black hole information paradox, where information may be lost. Does this topic have any theological implications?
Well, it does, and it's a major debate amongst theoretical physicists and observational physicists. Is information permanently lost when it's sucked into a black hole, or will a quantum tunnel out when all the energy trapped inside the black hole quantum tunnels out? You could argue theologically this has zero bearing, because the amount of time it takes for a black hole to become a white hole, and the principle is this, black holes have such a high density that they're undergoing gravitational collapse, and they just continue collapsing. And eventually they collapse down to such a tiny size that they reach the size of a quantum particle. And when that happens, the forces of quantum mechanics can become greater than the forces of gravity. And so that stops the gravitational collapse. And what you happen is everything that's been sucked into the black hole gets blasted out as a white hole. It quantum tunnels out. But it was Stephen Hawking that calculated how much time it would take for even the smallest black holes to become a white hole. The bigger the black hole, the longer it takes to collapse down to the size of a quantum particle. But even for the smallest conceivable black hole, the time exceeds 10 to the 66 years. So you could argue theologically, this is an immaterial question, because it's quite clear that God's going to move us from this creation to the new creation in a lot less than 10 to the 66 years. That's one with 66 zeros after it. And so the universe is absurdly too young for any possibility of a white hole event to happen. And what's been taking place is astronomers are trying to actually do accurate observations of the event horizon. And so you may have heard of the Event Horizon Telescope. It's a series of radio telescopes that are linked together around the world to take very high resolution maps of black holes. And so far they've produced one such map of the event horizon, and that's of the super, super massive black hole that's in the core of the M87 galaxy in the Virgo cluster. And the reason why is they're wanting to learn enough about the properties of what's happening in the event horizon to see if they can get some insight on this horizon problem of what happens to the information. But I can tell you, it's not settled. We need a lot more observations, and some new tools are coming on board for us to be able to figure out what's going on. For example, we can look at the images of very distant quasars and blazars. That also will give us some insight on what's happening at the event horizons of black holes.
Perfect, thank you. J.A. Masso says, hello everybody, quick question. So when it comes to the famous Australopithecus called Lucy, can we say that the remains of this being and perhaps many others are actually the remains of some extinct ape, or do these remains show some relation with human beings?
Yeah, there was some debate 20 years ago that maybe the Australopithecus find may be misinterpreted, and that's not what anthropologists think. But today there's a consensus that this was a real species. So, and you know, dates back about 4 million years ago, quite a small brain cavity. So, yeah, I personally believe that it's real, but we don't have a lot of evidence. That's another reason why anthropologists are now persuaded the population levels of these different species was small. We only see them on three continents, Africa, Europe, and Asia. We don't see them in North and South America or Australia, and we don't have a lot of bones. I mean, you can fit all the bones into one part of your garage. That's the total sum of bones that have ever been found. And that includes Neanderthals all the way back to the first species that dates back about 6.5 million years ago. And we don't see much evidence of them having an impact on other animals. So that's why they believe the population levels had to be as small as they believe. And by the way, I didn't say this, you know, Bill Craig's whole focus is on the reality of Homo heidelbergensis. A paper just got published. Fuzz is writing an article on it, which basically disputes the reality of heidelbergensis. So Homo heidelbergensis may not even be real. So the anthropological literature. And incidentally, I want to give credit to my colleague. Fuzz Rana has submitted a 3,500-word article to the Christian Research Journal, and it's going to be published soon. But he's also writing a thick 6,000-word article. These are both articles that review Bill Craig's book. And so a 6,000-word article will be posted on our website. And Fuzz's main critique of Bill's book is that it takes a certain skill to be able to read the anthropological literature. And, you know, he wishes that Bill had gotten more help, not just from one or two anthropologists or geneticists, but from a wide spectrum, or at least read widely through the anthropological literature. Because a lot of the claims he's making simply are not sustained if you look at the entirety of the anthropological literature. So that's going to be the prime theme of Fuzz's review that we'll be releasing shortly at reasons.org.
Thank you. Now, so with respect to Lucy, can we say that that is just the remains of some extinct ape and that that's not related to human beings?
Well, this is a bit of a debate, because what you see in the bipedal fossil record is that you don't see a gradual rise of increasing bipedal capability or increasing brain size relative to body size. Rather, it goes up and down like this. So for example, the latest bipedal primate that's been discovered, Homo florensis, actually has a brain that's the smallest of all the bipedal primates. So the smallest one shows up at the end. Homo heidelbergensis has a brain size that's the same as that of a chimpanzee, 4 times smaller than that of a human. And the only thing we see that has a roughly linear progression, this is something we got from Ian Tattersall, says notice as you go from the earliest bipedal primate up to the latest pre-human bipedal primates, namely the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, you do see a gradually increasing capability of the capacity of these creatures to hunt large bodied bird and mammal animals. And he was the one that tipped us off saying, I think this fits your creation model, reasons to believe, that God knew that we humans were in danger of wiping out the very bird and mammal species that God created to help us launch and sustain civilization. And so he created this sequence of bipedal primates basically to train these animals. When you see a tall bipedal with a weapon in its hand, run away. And therefore he points out, notice that the sub-Saharan Africa, that's where we have the greatest evidence for these bipedal primate species. The extinction rate of large body bird and mammal animals was only 4.5%. Australia, it was 94%, and explains why the Aborigines were not able to get out of the Stone Age. They lacked the animals they needed to launch sophisticated high technology civilization. And where we do see the launch of high technology civilization, it's only on the continents where you have these bipedal primates that predated us human beings.
Hugh, it's noon. I wasn't sure how long you wanted to go. You control that.
Yeah, okay. I can take one quick question and then we'll move into our web meeting.
Okay, Ryan Priori asks, he says, I've read most of RTB's material on the multiverse. I'm struggling with the ideas of it being real as a Christian. Does a multiverse containing an infinite amount of universes have negative consequences on the Bible and Christianity?
Yeah, I was hoping it would be a short question. I'll try to be as quick as possible. You'll find quite a bit on the multiverse in the 4th edition of The Creator and the Cosmos. And my colleague, Jeff Swearink, has written a whole book on the subject. But I cite in The Creator and the Cosmos 4th edition, Leonard Susskind. He's an atheist theoretical physicist. And he's been appealing to his atheist peers. We have to stop using the multiverse. It's a terrible argument for atheism. And says the reason why, it explains everything. And a model that explains everything explains nothing. He dropped it there. What I did in The Creator and the Cosmos 4th edition is give you an analogy to make Leonard Susskind's point that if you have an infinite number of universes where they're all different from one another, you're going to have an infinite number of planets, just like planet Earth. And you're going to have an infinite variety of trees on these planets. And you're going to have an infinite variety of birch trees. And birch trees have the property they peel white pieces of bark. And if you've got an infinite number of universes that were all different from one another, you're going to have an infinite variety of birch tree species. And one of those species is going to peel thin pieces of white bark that are rectangular in shape and measure 8.5 by 11 inches. And these pieces of bark will fall off the tree onto soils with random chemicals in them that'll make random markings on all these pieces of white bark. And with an infinite number of universes, you're going to duplicate all the research papers published by every research scientist since the beginning of time. And therefore, you'd be justified in concluding all these research papers did not come from the minds of scientists. The multiverse did it. So you're basically showing a philosophical inconsistency. Appealing to the multiverse to eliminate God's involvement in designing the universe simultaneously eliminates 100% of human design involvement. And so I would simply appeal to my atheist friends and say, look, you need to have a consistency in your philosophy. And Mark, you're a philosopher, and I think you would concur with that conclusion.
I agree. It doesn't make any sense to come up with something that does explain everything and doesn't explain how it explains it. In other words, it's a bald assertion. It's a fallacy.
Right. Well, what I'm going to do is give you the URL right now for our web meeting. We're in a webinar right now. So I'm going to need to go to the share feature. Let me do that.
Are you doing that, Hugh? I'm going to remind everyone that there were a few people who had questions, good questions, and we invite you to come back next week at 10:30 a.m. Pacific time and post your questions then. We'll have 15 minutes of Q&A. You get in first to say, hey, I posted these last week and didn't get answered, so could Hugh please take care of these? And we'll take care of you. We want to make sure everybody gets a shot at it.
Right. And I'll say this about Bill. I mean, he's a towering figure in the Christian community, highly respected, clearly well-educated and intelligent. And therefore, I think that explains why so much of that conference was focused on his book, his position, his theology, why he's changed some of his positions. But I think it's something that's rippling through churches all across the country. And I just kind of gave you a little bit of what was going on there. I'm definitely willing to entertain more questions on this. So, and we're hoping to actually record a report on this with our scholar community, and we'll make that publicly available. But next week, I also want to say a little bit about another day at that conference where the subject was biblical inerrancy. And that too is a major concern of the Evangelical Theological Society, because they're now aware a lot of their members have very different views on biblical inerrancy than what you see in the Chicago statements on biblical inerrancy. And then we're going to jump back into our study because, we're getting close to finishing up our study on dual revelation. So this is the URL you're going to need to get into the web meeting. Say, what's the difference? In the web meeting, we can all turn on our cameras and our microphones. We can engage one another. And by the way, we are getting close to launching the Paradoxes class as an in-person meeting. As soon as the technology is up and running, people are saying, what are we going to do about the Omicron variant? Well, it's not here yet, but I'm kind of in a wait and see mode there. I'll give you an update when that happens. But this is the URL you're going to need to get in the web meeting. It's your opportunity for fellowship, to get to know one another. But it's also a fun time where we get to role play conditions, get to report. And we had some questions today about sharing your faith. And I thought it'd be fun for us to actually talk about, because I've been doing role plays in the web meeting where we talk about, hey, talk about an encounter you had during the last week or two where you got to share your faith with a stranger. And I thought today would be a good time to answer the question, how do you recognize when God's giving you an opportunity to share your faith with a stranger? So yeah, if you can join us, please do. So at this point, I'm going to stop the share feature. And by the way, this URL is also posted at paradoxes.org. So you can go there and join the meeting. But I'm going to stop the share feature now. And we'll end the web meeting, the webinar, and we're going to launch the web meeting. And you'll be put into a waiting room. And just give me a minute to move you from the waiting room. And once you're out of the waiting room, you can turn on your cameras and microphones. So here goes.